We are back. Our guest is Dudley Clendenin, and Bill Russell and I are at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta. We went away talking about And They Become a Movement. Out of the African-American tradition, the black civil rights movement, I got a sense from John Lewis, a congressman here in Atlanta, that movement is a verb, to move. And I sort of had a sense of that as I was reading about what it took to get people energized around this issue. From invisible to movement is a long, long trip, isn't it?
It's a long trip, and it's a highly individual trip. It's a very personal. You know, the phrase in the late 60s in the radical years was politics is personal. You know, the personal is political. And that's not more true of any movement than this one. People, you know, this is a movement that learned from the women's movement, learned from the anti-Vietnam War movement, learned from the black civil rights movement and the black power movement, learned from all those movements, but then had to grow as the rest of them faded, you know, and had to grow sort of by itself against an increasingly conservative culture. And that's been one of the themes about it. And it's only grown under attack. Mm-hmm. That's really...
Yeah, when times got good, nothing happened.
No, nothing happened. And in the small sense, when the police raided the Stonewall Inn in the bar in the Greenwich Village in New York.
In 1969.
30 years ago, at the end of this month. That was an attack. And when they fought back, that was the first public resistance. But it has been things like that on that small scale or larger that have been... become the form of the movement through the last three decades.
You start your book, and I guess conceptually the start of this movement with Stonewall. And I think early on you say at that time, 1969, homosexuality was a crime, it was a sin, and it was a disease.
Right, we were crazy.
And I have a soft spot in my heart for stories that with happy endings. So I read all the way to the end of your book. And
at which time? It was no longer...
Well, there was progress. I mean, there was obviously progress, but it is not, you know, it's not over.
No,
this yet. Is... This is not... Frankly, I was looking for that last chapter that you haven't written yet, because it's not a happy ending, necessarily. There seems to have been substantive improvements with respect to all three of those. But there still seems to be a lot of resistance in the community at large.
Yeah, we haven't seen the end of this story yet. I don't know when we will. There, you know, in one way, and I think it is true, this movement has come farther, faster than any other civil rights movement in American history.
And you do think of this as a civil rights movement, don't you?
It is. It started as a movement of sexual liberation. And among radicals, you know, that was what was in the air. But it shifted pretty quickly into a civil rights movement, more a middle-class movement, under attack when Anita Bryant discovered it and became afraid for her children, you know. Then the sexual content, the basic sexual energy of the movement, was identified and became the issue again. But that's been the tension between the two, the civil rights and the movement for sexual liberation. It will never be resolved. And there's a big tension between men and women in the movement that will never be resolved because they have basically different kinds of interests. But lots of progress has been made if you consider that it started from zero. It's the only group that had no civil rights. You know, no right of assembly, no right to buy an ad in the Yellow Pages, no right to take out an ad in the newspaper to say, come meet with us. If you declared yourself, you were liable to be arrested or lose your license because, I mean, no psychiatrist could say even that he was or she was homosexual because she'd lose her license to help treat other homosexuals or anyone else, you know. So starting from zero, it's come a long way. We're not anymore... insane by definition since 1973.
When that was changed, there
at, right.
before 1973,
well,
it was insanity.
I'd like to take that a little further. mean, that's the one place, that disease part of the Trinity, mm-hmm. at the beginning, mm-hmm. Where there has been an unequivocal change, at least in terms of definitions and what is generally accepted to be current practice. But what it took to get the profession of psychiatry and psychology to make that move, to me, it's just an astounding story, and it's not pretty. The fact that it happened, I think, is a tribute to a few individuals, and ultimately, I think, the profession coming around. But what it took to get there is striking.
It's pretty dramatic, and at points was funny. And some of my favorite images in the book are when gay activists zapped psychiatric conventions and went racing up and took the stage, and psychiatrists standing on their chairs screaming, "Get out of here, you maniacs!" You know. It is very theatrical stuff, and theater as political pressure, and they were able to persuade the psychiatrists, first the board, you know, and then the whole population of psychiatrists in the country voted and decided it just didn't make any sense to keep a definition that was based on a perception of how the population felt to begin with. It wasn't a medical definition.
But it took one person, and I don't mean to diminish the importance of everybody that was involved in it. It sounded, you know, the way you report it, mm-hmm. There was one person who, you know, had a fairly well-formed notion, but was at least willing to examine the evidence. And that willingness and the willingness to follow the evidence wherever it led was really the difference. I mean, one person really made a difference in this case.
Right. Yeah, this is a movement where often one person made the difference. I mean, the first person who stood up and said, you know, psychiatrists can't speak for me, you know, I'm homosexual and I'm perfectly sane, was a man named Franklin Kameny. He was a Harvard-trained astronomer who'd been arrested by the police for suspicion, period. And it ruined his career. He was eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know, and could get no job, and it radicalized him. And so he looked at things around him and said, this isn't right. I'm not crazy, and I'm not criminal, and there's many of us as there are African Americans, and we deserve civil rights, and we can speak for ourselves. Those were radical ideas, and they had to find people in the Psychiatric Association who would listen to him and to people like him. And you know, take them into meetings, listen to them in forums, and begin to think, maybe they have a point. Maybe we ought to look in the mouth of the horse and see how many teeth there is instead of debating it, you know.
When I think about the McCarthy era, one of the very first things I think about is the blackmail associated with homosexuality and the big hoo-ha. It wasn't just communists. The homosexual and communists came together. The fear around homosexuality is just unspeakably large for many people. Is that part of what we are watching as we hear you tell this story through time, that the fear is diminished or people are coming to terms with it, or that this is a reality that you just have to suck it up and get ready to say, I'm not going to be afraid of that anymore? Because this fear element, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Kameny?
Kameny. Uh-huh.
Is the one who time and again shows up in your book as somebody who is willing to stand up and put himself at grave risk. Now, he had less to lose because he couldn't get a job. But over and over again, he was willing to deal with people's fears.
He was. He was unafraid. He was totally unafraid. And but it took a man who was totally unafraid to stand up and begin to let people who are afraid of homosexuals see one who was unafraid. I mean, that's, you know, that's what makes the difference.
I go back to McCarthy because this is a deeply American circumstance.
Uh-huh.
This isn't something that just happened when Anita Bryant got up and got outraged over orange juice or whatever. it seems to me that you are talking about large issues in a large social context that as you look at those 30 years, that the fact that McCarthy and the McCarthy era had such a direct relationship with issues around homosexuality is an important part of this story.
Well, it's the only... there was a very real witch hunt in the early 50s. Congress and the White House were involved and formed policy, you know, which said that homosexuals are a threat. And they shouldn't work in any responsible job. They shouldn't work in the federal government. They shouldn't be in the armed services. We should find them if we can and root them out. You know? And that was the atmosphere in which Kameny was arrested and radicalized. And that was basically a policy of the Republican Party then. And the two parties and the difference between them began to be evident from that time, 50 years ago, to now. Because if you come forward all the way to 1992, to the election, when Bill Clinton began appealing to people who were gay for their votes, and key figures in the Republican Party, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, began using homosexuals as a sort of boogeyman. You had a polarity, and that was what developed a national gay vote, which made a difference in states like Georgia, where Bill Clinton won by 16,000 votes, and almost certainly that difference was made by gay votes, by people, many of whom had voted Republican before. My point is that part of the long theme in this book is that homosexuals had to find, in political terms, had to find a home. They had to find friends. They had to find a party that was willing to seek their votes, want their money, and it became the Democrats. It wasn't the Republicans, because the Republicans found money in attacking homosexuals. So it's a long progression.
When we come back, you used a word earlier, zap. Mm-hmm. That is may not be a familiar word, and I'd like to. It raises some very interesting issues about how to change the world.
That's Bill Russell. I'm Paula Gordon. Our guest is Dudley Clendenin. We are at the St. Mark Methodist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, and we're all going to be back in just a moment.